Chapter 20. The Descent. The trio of gunships pierced the thick scrum of mist, engines whining like eager hounds. Noxious gases lashed the hulls, stripping the paintwork and corroding the ornamental gilding. Beyond the lashing winds and toxic clouds, nothing sought to bar their descent. No weapon systems, no aircraft, not even a sensor sweep. It was as if the planet were nothing more than it appeared. A cold, dead husk. Empty even of ruins or the barest sign of habitation or vegetation. The gunships landed with a chorus of dull thumps, their landing gear striking the firmly packed silvery sands of the planet's surface. Two belonged to Alconex. The third was Butcherbird. The disembarkation bays opened with a grinding of gears, disgorging their ramps. Mutants spilled out onto the surface of the silent world in a riot of baying, shrieking shapes. More quietly, but not by much, came the Emperor's children. Their numbers were divided evenly between those loyal to Alconex and the warriors of the 12th millennial. Savona, accompanied by Belophus, led the latter down their ramps. She had been roused from hiding by Fabius to serve as another pair of eyes. He could not count on old loyalties to protect him, as he had on Luganath. Too many among both parties of Empress children had reason to want him dead. But Savona's presence might offset Palos Gaia's influence somewhat. The bulky, eyeless warrior seemed willing enough to defer to Fabius's authority, but it was for the sake of appearances. Fabius watched him organize the disembarking procedures with bellows and swift clouts, pummeling both space marines and mutants alike when necessary.
"That one is going to be trouble," Skarlagrim said.
Fabius and his followers stood a short distance away from the gunships, conducting a sensor sweep of their surroundings.
"Of course he is. That's why Flavius sent him."
Fabius held up his Auspex, trying to understand what it was telling him.
"This makes little sense. It's as if there's not even a planet here. Sakara?"
"The same,"
the word-bearer said, studying his own Auspex.
"Something is scrambling our senses. Atmospheric distortion, perhaps."
"No. Can't you feel it? That wind isn't natural."
Korag held up a handful of shimmering sand. He let it dribble between his fingers.
"Neither is this sand. It's made of metal."
The wind caught the loose grains and carried them away. For a moment, they almost seemed to take the shape of a skeletal countenance before dispersing.
"We all saw that, yes?"
Skarlagrim asked.
"Yes. Something has a sense of humor."
Fabius lowered his device. The ground was spongy beneath his feet, with too much give to be as solid as it appeared. He sank to one knee and thrust his hand into the sand. He felt no resistance. It was as if the sand were all that there was. When he retracted his arm, it was covered in metallic grains. They slid across his armor, scraping the remnants of old paint from the ceramite. He examined his arm more closely, magnifying the optical feed of his helmet to microscopic levels.
"Fascinating. They are consuming the organic effluvia staining the ceramite. Paint, mold, even skin cells."
"They're eating us, you mean?"
Skarlagrim said, with disgust.
"Not for some time. They are lazy little beasts. Much like you, eh, Puzzles?"
Korag laughed and poured more of the false sand into his palm. His beast cavorted about his legs, snuffling and slavering. Its acidic perspiration hissed and popped where it dripped onto the sand.
"It would take them years to threaten the integrity of our battle plate."
The Grave Warden jerked his head towards the mutants.
"And at least a few months to eat through the environmental suits our malformed companions wear."
Fabius frowned. His battleplate's enhanced sensory apparatus was being tested to its limits, trying to define his surroundings. There were no weather patterns, no landmasses or oceans. Just the strange metal sand and the toxic gases, which he suspected were a byproduct of the sand. The glimmerings of a theory whispered in his mind, and he altered the parameters of his sensor sweep. A moment later, he gave a bark of laughter.
"Ah, solar radiation," he said, looking around. "That's what's interfering with our senses."
He gestured to the sand.
"This isn't sand. It is an untold number of nanomachines, minuscule solar cells. The clouds and the wind are some form of byproduct of the energy absorption, and so too is the interference, I'd wager. But where is it getting that sort of power? The only source of radiation would be the sun, but..."
Skarlagrim began. He stopped.
"Unless... no."
He looked down.
"Impossible." "Oh, not impossible. Merely improbable."
Korag clapped his hands free of sand.
"If so, then we are not on the planet's surface. There is no surface."
"Not as we'd recognize it, no,"
Fabius said. He laughed.
"Oh, what a pretty puzzle."
"What are you laughing about, Manflayer?"
Paulos rumbled, as he trudged towards them, followed closely by Savona. Diomat loomed behind them. The ancient dreadnought said nothing, but the way his claws flexed told Fabius he was growing impatient.
"This place, it is magnificent, is it not?"
Fabius gestured about himself with torment.
"It is empty,"
Savona spat.
"Nothing but dust and clouds."
"Appearances can be deceiving,"
Fabius said. He looked at Paulos.
"Your gunships, do they still possess standard signal jammers?"
The signal jammers were one of the few reliable methods of successful planetary insertion the traitor legions possessed. The jammers were able to create a rough window through an orbital sensor grid, enabling gunships to theoretically avoid automated defense systems and ground-to-air artillery. An early innovation of the Alpha Legion, provided, if somewhat grudgingly, to their fellow traitors in the later stages of the Solar War. Paulos shrugged.
"Of course, but we detected no hostile systems during the descent."
"Because it's not hostile, it's passive, and so far in advance of our own that I doubt it would recognize us as a threat, even if it wasn't."
Fabius started towards Butcherbird.
"The only way to get past it is to give it a bit of a shock, startle it, and take advantage of its surprise. Pain is the key that opens many doors, as I have often said."
"Startle what?"
Paulos demanded, as he and the others followed.
"This. All of it. This place. It's not a planet. Not really. It's more like the hull of a ship. An immense ship."
He scooped up a handful of sand.
"We have boarded it, but now we must make a breach."
It didn't take long to make the preparations. Even in their current state of degradation, there were yet some among the Third who possessed the wit to understand Fabius's plan as he explained it. The gunship's signal jammers would be attuned to a single frequency, one capable of momentarily disrupting the alien signal running through the nanomachines. The signal itself took some time to identify and isolate, but once it was done, it was a simple matter of programming the signal jammers to block it. After they'd been activated, Fabius and his fellow apothecaries retreated to Butcherbird's passenger bay to observe the next phase of the experiment.
"I do not see how all of this will help us find what we've come for, Manflayer,"
Paulos said, as Fabius bent over the controls of the hololithic projector in the bay.
"We are supposed to be searching for a ship, not playing with sensors."
"Has it ever occurred to you to ask why our prize is here, Paulos? Why here, so far from Terra? How did it come to be here? Who brought it?"
Fabius cocked his head.
"Or perhaps you're of a religious frame of mind. Did the gods deposit it here, a grail waiting to be claimed by the worthy?"
"What else could it be?"
"An infinite number of things.
The universe is vast and unknowable, and I suspect that this place is one of those unknowable things.
It seems fairly knowable to me,
says the warrior without eyes. You look, but do not see.
Fabius hesitated. He shook his head.
The sun is artificial. It is a vast assemblage of mirrors, angled with inhuman precision, in order to capture residual solar energies from elsewhere and transmit them to the planet. The question is, where is it capturing them from?
Palos shrugged.
I do not care.
You should, because it appears to be drawing those residual energies from this planet. A continuous loop of energy, generated, refined, and returned. The question is, why?
Fabius tapped the controls, causing the hololithic image of the world to twist and reshape itself.
Because this is not a natural planetoid, but instead an artificial one. This crust of nanomachines is but the hull of something unseen.
Hull? What sort of hull has an atmosphere?
Palos snorted.
You are mad!
The same way atmosphere might be caught within certain types of energy field. The air, corrosive as it is a by-product of the nanomachines, a form of artificial photosynthesis.
Fabius shook his head.
Perhaps it's some type of archaeotech, a Xenos terraforming device. It would take more time than I suspect we possess to fully understand the process.
He tapped the image, causing it to spin and flatten, until it displayed a three-dimensional representation of the area around the gunships.
Once the theory presented itself, it was a simple matter to alter our senses to counter the interference. If I am right, we will see what lies beneath these false sands momentarily. Ah, listen.
A sound like sand caught in a windstorm slithered into the gunship. Fabius strode out of the bay and paused at the top of the ramp. The air had thickened, as if to herald a storm, and the sands were shifting. It was as if something were moving beneath them, or sinkholes were opening up. Hummocks surged upwards, only to collapse inwards with a thunderous hiss. The effect radiated outwards in a perfect circle around the gunships. The ground trembled beneath them, and Fabius fancied he could see vast inhuman faces forming in the shifting sands as they rose into the air or fell away.
Look! The sky!
Savona shouted from the foot of the ramp. She gestured with her maul. Fabius laughed as he saw the flat, colourless sky darken and become scored with hundreds of slashes of flickering, sickly green. It put him in mind of impact striations on an overtaxed void shield. Ripples of vibrant colour growing wider and brighter as the sky itself seemed to lose cohesion and slough away. The wind was roaring with hurricane force now, howling through the gulfs and valleys of collapsing sand. The sky was lashed by waves of green fire. Sand washed over the gunships, nearly blinding Fabius despite his helmet. There was a sound like the groaning of primeval mechanisms prodded into motion. The tremors running beneath them grew more savage, and the gunships creaked on their shocks. Mutants wailed in panic, and some fought to clamber back aboard the ships, only to be beaten back by their overseers. Palos caught at Fabius's arm. His voice crackled over the vox frequency.
What have you done? We will be destroyed if this continues.
Fabius laughed.
I think not. Look.
He thrust Torment out, indicating the storm front of green lightning that swept towards them. Where the lightning struck, the sands crackled and surged upwards, higher and higher over them. Or perhaps they were going down. He felt the shudder of rotation and heard the creak of metal. The patch of ground that the gunships had landed on was descending beneath the undulating nanomachine sands. The sand rushed around the three gunships like the torrent of a whirlpool, intermingling with the eerie lightning. The lightning spread, becoming veins of glowing green in curved, smooth walls as the sand slowly ceased its motion and became firm once more before it receded upwards. The ground, The platform shuddered and came to a halt. Its rotation ceased as antediluvian locking mechanisms slammed down on the rim of the circular platform. Fabius looked around in growing wonder. Jade lumens flickered to life across the vast space that they now found themselves in. In the emerald radiance, Fabius saw that their platform was one among hundreds, each set equidistant from the others, and at varying heights, mounted atop deceptively thin towers of some smooth, featureless metal. Instinctively, he activated his armor's augurs, trying to create a sensor map of his surroundings. Each of the platforms was connected by a single walkway to the edge of an immense circular tier. There were thousands of tiers, rising to impossible heights and descending to imperceptible depths, all along the vertical curve of what could only be a colossal sphere. Each of the tiers was occupied by what appeared to be a labyrinth of prismatic galleries, winding back into the heart of the vast structure. And all were slowly, almost imperceptibly, moving, rotating the way a world might turn in its place in the firmament.
Maybe an artificial gravity well, keeping the megastructure from flying apart, he murmured in awe, despite himself.
Questions sped across the surface of his mind, one after the next. This place was nothing so much as a gargantuan orrery, built around a caged power source of incalculable potency.
I was right, he said, thumping the ramp of the gunship with the ferrule of his scepter.
The sound echoed loudly in the silence.
It's a Dyson sphere.
I've never seen one this big, Palos said. Oh, so well camouflaged.
He started down the ramp. Fabius followed, more slowly.
I would guess that it has been here for some time, longer than humanity has prowled the stars. In certain Aldari texts, it speaks of a great war in heaven. Most of it is allegorical nonsense, as could be expected of such a culture. But if you compare it to other Xenos records, there are hints. Star gods and cannibal suns, warp spawn and soulless legions that were more monstrous than any abominable intelligence. Machines that devour entire worlds for fuel, and vampiric entities that drained the energy from stars. Cannons that could split reality with a single shot.
Fabius smiled.
A war that laid waste to every galaxy in the universe. A war our existence has yet to recover from. Glorious to think of, isn't it?
Palos grunted.
If it is the truth.
What is truth but the perception of fact?
Fabius descended past him. His mutants greeted him with quiet murmurs, their enthusiasm dampened by the vast silence. The causeway connected to their platform was wide enough for an army to march across, 100 abreast. They hadn't quite brought an army, but close. Under the direction of his overseers, mutants set up a pair of primitive heavy stubbers at the edge of the platform. A number of his creatures would remain behind to defend the gunships, under the command of Belophus. Around the platform, mutants and space marines readied themselves to depart. Raucous singing rose from among the ranks of the 12th millennial, while those loyal to Alconex were more circumspect. Diomat stood apart from all of this, staring out at the tiers. The others gave the dreadnought a wide berth, and Fabius could not blame them. Diomat was a thing apart, even now. Fabius joined him at the edge of the platform.
This world is a tomb, the dreadnought said.
Yes.
But it is here.
According to Eidolon,
Diomat grunted.
Ah, you should never have reattached his head.
Mistakes were made.
Diomat gave a grinding, mechanical laugh.
Yes. That is the story of us, is it not?
He flexed his claws.
We make mistake after mistake and call it perfection. This is but the latest. Perhaps it will be our last. Your last mistake. Your last failure, brother. How does it feel? I have not failed. I have merely been unsuccessful, Fabius said. Eidolon boasts of a new beginning, and I will give him one. I will give us all one.
Another false laugh. Nearby mutants cringed at the harsh, rasping tones.
Hubris, brother! There is a saying about pride and falls. Then you shall just have to catch me, Fabius said.
Diomat looked down at him.
We will see.
The dreadnought fell silent. Fabius did as well. Maybe Diomat was right. Maybe he was simply an old man yearning for a past that had never existed. A chance to do things over. He looked down at himself. Healthy now. Unbent. Strong. Death did not crowd him. Not yet. Perhaps that was it. With thoughts unclouded by imminent dissolution, his mind naturally turned down familiar paths. Was that to be the story of him then? A cycle of nostalgia and panic repeated ad nauseam until the day his creations could stand on their own. Then this time might be different. With Fulgrim and a renewed legion to ward them, his new men might prosper, even as old humanity had. He could teach them. Teach Fulgrim and the newborn legion. Teach them to avoid the mistakes of the past and prevent them from collapsing in on themselves as his brothers had done.
How are we even going to find what we're looking for? Search every tier,
Savona said, as she joined him at the edge of the platform. Startled from his reverie, he glanced at her. Her armor bore fresh battle pacts, he noted. She was not of the Legion, but she well knew the way to their heart. Debased as they were, they still valued such things in their leaders.
No. As a member of the Apothecarian, I have the transponder codes for every gene ship that served our Legion. Useless now, most of them, but some are still in use, though under different names and by different masters.
He laughed.
A fact which has served me well on occasion. Doubtless, this is one of the reasons Eidolon decided I was needed. Without the proper codes, it might take decades to locate the vessel in such a place. I can locate it in mere days.
A gene ship,
Savona hissed.
Is that all we're here for?
Fabius glanced at her.
Is that all? It is everything, woman. The key to our survival is something other than gene-enhanced monsters or maddened spawn. Even my skills have their limits, and this will ensure the Legion's continued existence for generations to come.
A fact the Lord Commander Primus is counting on,
Palos rumbled, joining them.
They say it contains a tithe of gene seed to rival the Vaults of Terra.
He glanced up at Diomat and made as if to speak, but fell silent. The dreadnought ignored him.
Not quite. But close. In the early days of the Great Crusade, our gene stock was among the most reliable, as well as one of the largest. Progenoids developed quickly and endured the rigors of transport more easily than others. Were it not for the blight, the loss of this vessel would have barely been noticed. As it was a disaster.
A sensor pinged, and he tapped at his vambrace, calling up a hazy hololithic map. A flashing mote bobbed along the hazy edge.
There. It's still transmitting, as I'd hoped. Or something is, at least. Background radiation is making it difficult to compose an accurate sensor map, but we have a general direction.
He turned.
Sakara! It is time!
The word-bearer pushed his way through the crowd of mutants, his demon flasks clattering.
You'll have a signal?
He asked.
Of course.
Very well.
Sakara unhooked a flask and murmured softly, running a finger over it in what might have been a calming manner. As he drew close to Fabius, the demons within his flasks grew agitated.
They hate you, Fabius,
Palos observed. The demons.
I've never heard them make that sort of noise. Usually it's all laughter and whispers.
Why should they be any different to the rest of us?
Savona said.
The Neverborn are stories made flesh, Sakara said, holding up the flask.
The formless thing within slammed minuscule fists against the walls of its prison.
Stories of murder and fear, despair and hope, of excess and cruelty. They are warnings and retributions hammered into shape by our belief. They are what we make of them.
He looked at Fabius.
And he makes of them nothing. He denies them, denies the story of them. It infuriates them, down to the very root of their conception.
Fabius smiled.
As I will always deny them. I will not play the willing meat for such lazy parasites. If they want my belief, they must show me something more than they have already.
The thing in the flask grew agitated, causing it to shudder in Sakara's grip. Fabius leaned close, smile widening.
But that would require some degree of true sentience, I fear. Something these thought forms are singularly incapable of. They are nothing but cunning mirrors, hollow and empty. But they do make wonderful scouts.
Sakara turned and popped open the flask. The thing inside spewed forth like a gout of smoke. The word-bearer gestured, and the demon smoke coiled about his hand for a moment before shooting off into the maze of tears. He repeated the process several times, whispering to each,
"Vast as this place is, it will take them some time," he said.
Fabius thumped the platform with torment.
"Then we had best get started. Come, the future awaits."
Aboard the Vesalius, Igori felt a moment of dim panic. Fear was not an unknown among the Glandhounds. It had its uses, so long as it was not allowed to overwhelm you. Her fingers brushed across the hilt of her knife as the tang of blood, augmented blood, new man blood, reached her nose. She pressed herself flat to the wall and extended her knife, using the flat of the blade to capture the reflection of the corridor around the corner. The hatch to the apothecarium was open, but no alarms were sounding. Someone had disabled them. The lumens of the corridor flickered weakly. Power was being diverted from this section. The members of her pack who should have been on guard were nowhere in sight. She had come to check on the benefactor's guest, as she had every hour since his departure for the planet below. Her warriors had not reported in as she'd expected. Igori drew her shuriken pistol and crept towards the open apothecarium, moving silently, every sense straining. She heard nothing, not the rasp of breath or the telltale whine of powered armor, and all she could smell was blood. Inside, the apothecarium was a shambles. Examination slabs had been upended, materials dumped and scattered. The walls had been gouged by blades, and the floor was littered with papers and effluvia from shattered specimen jars. The worst of it was the bio-creches. All of them had been cracked open and their contents destroyed, including the nascent clones of the benefactor. These had been crushed and chopped apart, as if to ensure their destruction, or to amuse the desecrators. The sight of such defilement gave her pause, and she almost missed the bodies lying stacked and split open on the remains slabs. Her packmates, butchered like cattle, their muscles and ligaments strung about and their organs set aside, as if for later sampling. She repressed a snarl of rage. These were not wounds earned in battle, but post-mortem mutilation, if she judged the wounds on their throats and skulls rightly. They had been killed quickly and efficiently, the work of the prey. Fearful now, she moved through the carnage towards the back of the chamber where the guest was hidden. Had he done this? She did not think so. The Empress' children had been growing restless in the wake of the benefactor's departure, testing the limits he had established. Perhaps they had come looking for chemical relief, or had simply been following some maddened whim. But she suspected otherwise. They had come looking for something, but had they found it? Igori tapped the control panel set into the wall. The picked feed of the cell's interior flickered. The guest's chamber was empty. Panicking slightly now, she opened the door, nostrils flaring at the scent of a demigod. He smelled like prey, but not. Headier somehow, overwhelming rather than enticing. She looked up. The access panels of the cell's ceiling had been removed. She holstered her weapons and leapt, easily catching the sides of the hatch. She boosted herself up into the access tunnel above. She had to find him. The benefactor had entrusted him into her keeping, and she could not fail him. Few living things could spend more than a few hours in the cramped labyrinth of convoluted tunnels, amid the artificial jungle of cables and fiber bundles, and the constant drip of oily water. Rusted metal creaked beneath her weight as she climbed, following the scent of her quarry. She climbed to and fro in the darkened subworld, her senses straining against the conditions. She could hear Vatborn scuttling just out of sight, and worse things besides. She could feel the steady hum of power running through the conduits, travelling to the various decks. Up ahead, something clanked. She heard a soft exhalation and smelled a sudden, acrid odour. Not quite blood, but something close. When she spotted him, he was crouched on a gantry, his long limbs bent, his silver head bowed. She was convinced that she had made no sound, but even so, his head whipped around, and a lavender gaze pinned her in place.
"Who are you?"
His voice was soft, surprisingly so. She had expected a lion's rumble. His gaze seemed lumen bright as he studied her. The beast dangled from his bloody grip, its malformed limbs shattered, its bloated skull lolling on a snapped neck.
"You remind me of a face I saw, as if in a dream. A woman's face, a woman's voice, whispering quiet words that I cannot recall. She sang to me, I think, when I was an infant."
He let the body he was holding fall. The creature had been large, something from the underverse that had sneaked into the ship during one of those all-too-common moments when the Geller field fluctuated. Whatever it was dead now. He looked at his bloody hands and wiped them across the ragged environmental suit he wore.
"Perhaps you are my sister." "Cousin," Igori said after a moment.
She rose from her crouch and slid her knife back into its sheath. She hadn't even remembered drawing it.
"I think I am your cousin."
"Family, all the same," Fulgrim said. He looked down at the creature.
"It was eating the little ones, the Vatborn, stealing their young. They whispered of it to me, begged me to help. So I came to kill it."
"You did a good job."
He flexed his hands.
"It felt good to kill it. It felt right."
He looked at her.
"Was it evil?" "It looked evil."
"It was hungry," she said simply.
In the dark, and several levels away, something roared. A feral howl, full of bestial malice.
"And it wasn't alone. Come." "I do not fear them," he said it petulantly, like one of her own pups denied a place at the kill.
She grinned without humour and fought to hold his gaze. It was hard, like staring into the power cell of a plasma weapon, but she held him nonetheless. She had stared down worse things than a half-grown demigod in her time.
"Then you are stupid," she said firmly. "They will hunt you as a pack. They will kill you as a pack, or hurt you enough that the next pack finishes the job. Come, now."
She was not sure where they could go. She only knew that she could not return him to the apothecarium. It was no longer safe. Fulgrim blinked and nodded.
"Yes, cousin."
He followed her slowly, with a stately grace that was at once predatory and elegant. His great size seemed no hindrance in the cramped maze of access tunnels. He smelled of the warp and of clean running water, and for a moment she fancied that he was more liquid than solid. "If you are found, it will go badly for the benefactor," she said, as they climbed along a steep chute. Power conduits thrummed along either side of them, and she could see strange crystalline spiders spinning delicate webs among the flickering nodes. "Why?" She shook her head. "Do not ask why. He has said, and so it is." "Why do you call him benefactor?" She grunted, full of curiosity, this one. "Is your pretty head empty? Is that why you seek to fill it with answers to foolish questions?" A flash of something that might have been anger crossed his face. "I was curious." "A bad habit aboard this ship." He fell into a sullen silence. She glanced down at him on occasion, checking to make sure he was still following. After a time, she asked, "How did you get out?" "I followed the Vatborn. They showed me the secret paths." He paused. "I hear things in these hollow places." "What things?" "They mean to kill him." He said it so urgently that she stopped and turned. He looked at her. "They mean to kill you." She said nothing for a moment. Then softly, "When?" "Soon." His eyes glowed with intent. "The Vatborn have heard them as well. They do not notice the little ones and speak freely about them. They would destroy all that Fabius has made, and I cannot allow that. I cannot allow them to harm him." She thought of the apothecarium and the bodies she had left there, of the destruction of the lab. She could smell war on the wind. Whatever the benefactor intended, she did not think she could wait to strike. Not if she wanted her pack to survive. She looked at him. "Come, I will take you someplace safe, and then we will decide what to do, cousin."